Hi, my name is Ben Armstrong.
Hi, this is David Koch.
My name is Thomas Maurer.
Hi, I'm Donna Sarkar.
Hi, my name is Lana Montgomery.
Hi, I'm Seth Warres.
Hi, I'm Aaron Thomas.
I'm Jess Dodson.
Hi, I'm Rocky Heckman.
Hi, I'm Sonia Cuff.
Hi, I'm Troy Hunt.
Hello, this is Wally Mead.
My name is Reid Purvis.
Hi, I'm Lars Flynn.
Hi, my name is Alan Birchall.
Hi, I'm Adam Fowler.
Hi, I'm Sky Guthrie, and you're listening to the Need to Know podcast.
All the latest Microsoft Cloud news, as well as industry guest deep dive conversations. It's a Need to Know podcast. All thanks to the CIA Ops patron community. The Need to Know podcast. Catch us on Twitter and Facebook, N2K Podcast, and online at ciaops.podbean.com.
Welcome along to the Need to Know podcast. My name is Robert Crane, and you join me for episode 269. Thank you very much for taking the time to listen along to this episode and all the information that I hope to bring you around the Microsoft Cloud, including Microsoft 365 and Azure. Plenty of information to get through, but probably a place to kick off for this news and update is the introduction or the announcement of the Windows 11 product. So a week or so ago, Microsoft announced Windows 11. A lot of controversy, I suppose, a lot of talk about this new operating system. I'll put all the links in the show notes for you to go and have a look at. There are concerns about the requirements around things like the TPM chip. So you need TPM version 2 to appear at this stage. Also, if it's a home edition, you will probably need to connect to the internet and have a Microsoft account. So there's a lot of that consternation floating around. A lot of the specs are probably not as clear as they could be. So in general, what I'll leave you with, again, in the show notes is a link to all of these announcements, all of the places that you can start if you are keen on having a look at this, having a look at the event. I'll also put in there the specific sites and announcements around Windows 11 for business and for enterprise. So there are some additional features in that, but I do advise you to go in and have a look at, you know, all the posts that are there and read through them, have a look at the event. Now, my take on all of this is pretty simple. I think that we're very, very early days into this. Yes, it was announced. It appears to be largely an interface GUI update. So yes, it looks prettier. There are some nicer things to do with the screen. There are some productivity enhancements around the product, but at its base level, it's still Windows 10. The management capability is still going to be done with things like Intune and so on. It's going to connect happily to Azure AD as Windows 10 does. And we expect to see the specific Windows 11 management tools and policies roll out into Intune as we go forward. Now, the timing for this apparently is that it won't be available on new machines until probably the late October, early November timeframe. And at the same time, there would be the option for early adopters, so for seekers to go out and to update their existing systems, provided they are compatible. From what I see, pretty much any modern system should have the capability to upgrade to Windows 11 without too much drama. However, obviously the big push as part of this operating system is going to be around, well, to get the most out of it, you're going to need a new device. So again, keep that in mind, but I think there's a lot of panic for, or a lot of consternation out there when there probably really doesn't need to be any until we get closer to the announcement, the actual release. And we expect to see changes from Microsoft, updates and so on that will, I think, change the end product slightly to widen the audience and overcome some of the resistance points that people have pointed out. So my advice to you is go in and have a look, understand what it is, see what the benefits are, be aware of it. But I really don't think there's anything to spend a lot of time on as yet. And I think you're quite able to sit back, watch what's happening, and then come the October, late October, early November timeframe, which I would also expect to also be Ignite from Microsoft as well. So that sort of time period is when I'd really be starting to worry about it. And I don't think it's going to hit mainstream probably until 2022. So at this stage, again, I would tell most people that there's not a lot to concern you. Just keep up to date with the news and the postings and really get on with business as usual. Now, if you really do want to get early access to Windows 11, Windows Insiders can do that. You'll find the links and all of that in the notes that I put up for the show. So go and have a look at that. If you're a Windows Insider, you can also get access to that preview, I believe, in the next week or so. It's going to be early days for this. I expect a lot to change for the product. So, but if you really want to be early to the game and see what it is and run it, by all means, go and do that. But in general, I'd be advising most people just to sit on their hands, keep abreast of the news, and get ready for an October, November sort of rollout commencing. Now, another change that Microsoft has been shadowing for a long, long time is the update or the removal of basic authentication with Exchange Online. So basic authentication is typically where you see a dialog box that has a username and a password in that same dialog, and that is an indication of an older style protocol. Now, typically associate basic auth with things like POP and IMAP, and they, if they are enabled with basic auth, that allows an attacker potentially to run a password spray attack, basically a brute force attempt at guessing passwords in Microsoft 365. So Microsoft has turned this off with things like security defaults, and it's continuing to work through tenants, looking at tenants that actually don't use basic auth now and disabling it anyway, and working its way through all the other tenants. But there's an article here that will give you a better indication of basic auth and the changes Microsoft's talking about. If you are still using basic auth, especially you see it with multifunction printers, I'd advise you to use other services like SMTP to go to overcome that, and if you can, to remove basic auth throughout your organization to improve security, because one of the big vectors for attack is going to be password guessing, which they can run in an automated manner. So again, go in, have a look at this article from Microsoft, Basic Authentication and Exchange Online, the June update. Have a read through and see if it does affect you. Chances are it probably won't, but again, the information's there. Now, Microsoft has also announced some updates to its attack simulation training. Now, typically this has been part of Defender for Office 365 P2. So this allows you to run simulations and send, you know, phishing style emails to users and then help them understand what the issues are and what to look for, and then provide them additional training. So there's some information there about the enhancements that Microsoft has made to that training program. Again, that's built in to any license that includes Office 365 Defender. So go in, have a look, update that information, have a look for yourself. And there's lots of really good things in there when it comes to training. There are third-party products out there that provide that, but by all means, go and have a look and consider that as an option for your environment as well if you don't already have it. Now, another thing that Microsoft has documented for us here is a really good blog post, I think, on how Microsoft 365 encryption safeguards data. Now, what it does is it goes through and it works through many of the options, things like customer lockbox, the compliance options, all of those things specifically aimed at helping you understand how encryption works in the environment, in the service, where it can be enabled, what services take advantage of it, and links off to articles to help you enable all of that. So again, this is going to make data more secure. A lot of these encryption protocols are enabled by default, but there are some certainly that you should go and enable around a policy environment, which means making decisions about, you know, what do you want to encrypt and so on. So go in, have a look at that, read that article, but it gives you a nice base if people are concerned about, you know, how's Microsoft protecting the data, encrypting the data. A really good summary article for you there to go and have a look at. Now, another interesting one that dropped recently was Microsoft announcing that you can rename your SharePoint domain. So typically, a SharePoint domain is typically domainname.sharepoint.com. And if you needed to change that for any reason, you couldn't. It was pretty much locked in. So you had to be very, very careful when you were choosing your tenant name, because that appeared at the beginning of the URL. And again, like I said, couldn't be changed. Now, Microsoft has an article here, which I'll link to in the show notes, that basically shows you the steps or what's required to go in and change this. Now, I will note that this, in this article, again, some of this is only available to a select group of customers, private preview. You can request to join it. It's obviously coming, so don't think that it's something you can necessarily implement immediately, but it's something that has been asked for quite a long time, and I expect to see this rolled out fairly quickly from Microsoft. But if you do want the information there, I'll put the link in the show notes, but just be prepared to understand that you probably can't change it immediately. You can obviously opt to join the private preview and see if you're accepted. Else, again, you'd have to wait till this rolls out to GA. So go in, have a look at the article, see what it says, understand what is possible and the direction that Microsoft is moving in when it comes into this capability. So the documentation, again, will be there. Now, I've got a pretty good interview. I'm really keen on this one, so we'll get into that in a moment or two, but I'll just call your attention firstly to a security event I'm running in Melbourne on the 5th and the 6th of August. Again, that's SecWorks, and that's going to be an end-to-end look at security for the Microsoft 360 environment, including device management, Windows 10 hardening, Exchange Online configuration, and so on. I'll put the link in the show notes. So if you are in Australia, you are keen to attend, that's a two-day event focusing solely on Microsoft 365 security. The early bird discounts end on the 5th of July, which is only about a week away. So again, if you are interested, please go in and sign up and take advantage of that. Apart from that, as always, I will call out the usual ways to get in contact with me on the Twitters, at DirectorCIA. You can also send me an email, director@ciaops.com. So lots of ways you can do that. Please feel free to get in contact with me. Let me know who you'd like on the interview, any feedback that you do have around the podcast. And again, I'll take this opportunity to thank you very much for the time listening, and I hope you enjoy this episode of the Need to Know podcast. Welcome to the interview for this episode, and I'm joined by Matt Sosman from Microsoft. Welcome, Matt.
Hey, thanks for having me. Good to be here.
Excellent. As always, for those who may not know Matt, which probably isn't a huge amount of people, I would hope, but Matt, why don't you give us a bit of a background as to your journey, career journey, and your role currently with Microsoft?
Yeah, sure. Been in my career for just a little over 20 years. Started way back when I was actually coming right out of high school and going into college, taking classes at, you know, in IT, working some local help desk jobs at a few companies. From there, moved into a sysadmin role at a local, you know, kind of small business where I was living at the time. That eventually led to some other sysadmin roles, which led to working at bigger companies, went on to work at Sprint. I was there for a long time doing unified communications and telecommunications networking and all sorts of fun stuff. That led into going to BlackBerry, at the time Research in Motion, which made BlackBerries. That was a lot of fun, going and traveling the world, visiting various organizations, talking about BlackBerry Enterprise Server, if you remember that. And then from there, went to Microsoft and been at Microsoft for just shy of 10 years. Was originally in the consulting service division, or Microsoft Consulting Services, going out there and implementing these fine products that I love talking about. And then last couple of years, I have been in our partner organization, helping our partners out there take these security products and build practices with them, help them use it with their customers to be successful. So a lot of fun, love what I do. And man, I just enjoy the technology.
All right, so what we might start off on is not so much the Microsoft tech, which I'm sure we'll get to in the security side, that's fantastic.
Sure.
But for those people who may not be aware, Matt has, you know, an excellent YouTube channel, which I'll put in the show notes that everybody should subscribe to, covering off many videos, particularly focused on the security side, and we'll probably get into the content of those. But give us some thoughts and give us some sort of background on the creation of this YouTube channel. Now, I'd assume that it was something that came from your own desire. Is that correct? What's sort of the genesis of your YouTube channel?
Yeah, that's a good question. Everybody wants to ask me that. And there was a lot of reasons why. I'll kind of give you just kind of short background. We can always expand on it. But way back when I was in Microsoft Consulting Services, you know, working as a consultant here at Microsoft, I would go out to some of our largest enterprise customers and help them, you know, implement these security products. And you know, oftentimes there would be things like, you know, questions that would come up. There would be discussion topics, and you know, rather than maybe repeating myself in an email, or rather than maybe typing out a long email, I thought, hey, let's write a blog. And so that got me into blogging, which then led to things like, on LinkedIn or and on Twitter, I would see people that have a lot of technical questions around the products. And that led me to writing blog articles and then responding with the link. And that was back when Microsoft had its TechNet blogs, if you remember those. And at one point, the TechNet blogs eventually started shutting down. And I thought, oh no, what am I going to do? And when I was writing these blogs, it was a lot of fun because, I'll come back to this in a minute. But anyway, so the blogs were kind of shutting down, and I thought, gosh, what's next? Do I do my own blog site? Do I go out and maybe start doing some YouTube videos? And that's when I started finding and discovering YouTube, and one thing led to another, and there I go. But the reasons behind it all is, it certainly helps me scale my day job, as I mentioned. But the other part of it too is, I've been here for a long time at Microsoft, even before then, just IT for 20 years. And I've always found that, labbing something up, getting hands-on, playing with the thing, the technology, is a really good way to learn. Especially in the security field, when you can simulate some threats, kind of attack the system, watch how it responds. And when you write a blog or you shoot a video, it kind of forces you to learn about that thing. And so another reason why I started doing the blogging and eventually the YouTubing was when new things came out, it gave me a reason to go learn it so I can make a video about it. So it was a way for me to keep up to date on my skills, which, if you're going to do that, you have to be accurate. So you really got to study and learn it. So that was a lot of fun doing that. And then people started hitting me up on LinkedIn and Twitter asking, hey, I'm trying to get into the IT field, or, hey, maybe I'm a Google person and I'm trying to learn Microsoft, whatever the case may be, asking, hey, where do I go to learn this stuff? And ask me some very specific things. I'm like, gosh, I'll just make some videos about it. So there's many different reasons why I started doing it, but it's really just kind of a way to give back. Of course, it helps me scale my day job, but it's also just a lot of fun. My wife, she gets upset with me sometimes when I want to spend a whole Saturday making videos, but it just kind of turned into a hobby, really.
And I think probably what a lot of people don't appreciate is your video might be 3 minutes, but there's probably 10 times, 20 times the amount of work behind the scenes, setting up the lab, as you mentioned, and getting it right and getting the screenshot, and then halfway through the wrong error pops up or, something like that. So it's a huge amount of work for, what appears a very polished output. So I think that was sort of the next question is do you have a schedule and say, right, I'm going to do a video a week, or I'm going to spend this time, or is it, just a, I feel passionate about this product or this solution or this answer that I've worked out, I'll create a video. Do you have a regularity around it, or is it just sort of an ad hoc when the moment grabs you?
Yeah, it kind of depends on the time of year and what I have going on in my day job. As I mentioned, I do use the videos as a way for me to kind of scale my day job. So if a topic comes up that I happen to be working with one of my partners on, I'll usually make a video and use that with them. But then there's other times where, I might take some vacation, or I might have some time off, or I'm just, have kind of a light week going. And that's where I make some videos, or if it's a rainy day on a weekend, especially during the pandemic and lockdowns and all those types of things, I got a lot of videos done, but really no set schedule. Although I do take time. I'm big into walking. I'm a big exerciser, and I go running and I do a few miles every day. And so I listen to podcasts, but then I also do a lot of thinking when I'm on those walks and runs about, okay, what are some of the latest topics out there that I should be doing some videos on, and what do I hear out there in the community? So I do put thought into it, and I do get an input and influence from others out there that and kind of help me prioritize. But yeah, to your point, I mean, to make a video, there is a lot of work that goes behind the scenes, and of course, creating the content, editing it. But as I mentioned, labbing it up, making sure your environment's working, and sometimes stuff doesn't work and it breaks, and troubleshooting that. I spend some days where literally a whole Saturday was consumed trying to shoot one video because stuff's not working right in your lab, and you figure out it's your fault, right? But Yeah, really no set schedule, but I do have a list of topics, and I have a little notebook on my desk that I run through and you know, jot down ideas, and you know, especially when you know new announcements come out from like Ignite and that kind of thing. Yeah, so it's kind of fluid.
It can't be as embarrassing as recording a podcast and not turning recording on. So that is something that's now on my checklist to make sure that I do, and I have verified that it is on for this episode. Now, yeah. The final thing on the YouTube side of things before we maybe transition into the security and the Microsoft products is, I do notice that over time that you've tried, you know, different approaches with the intros and different presentation styles and you know, over the time, and you've obviously tried to improve that. What sort of, you know, for somebody who wants to get into YouTube or wants to do this same sort of capability to share with people, what have you learned that you found has worked really well and people have responded to, and what have you found basically people, you know, haven't responded to that you thought, oh, hang on, you know, this would be really good, and it hasn't sort of turned out that way from a production side?
Yeah. So actually, I'll go back to when I wrote blogs, and I'll jump into my YouTube videos here in a second. But back when I was writing blogs, I had to get past writer's block. I had to get past trying to make it perfect. And I had to finally realize, look, I'm going to make mistakes. I'm only human. And frankly, that's the fun part about reading somebody's blog is they do make mistakes, and they are human, and it's not a technical white paper. And so once I got past that point, then I started having to put myself in the reader's shoes. And okay, you know, I'm an IT pro as well. So what would I expect to see? I would expect to see screenshots. I would expect to see technical information and being able to, you know, be linked out to other resources to go learn more, that kind of thing. And so when I take over to videos, I had to put myself kind of in the shoes of the viewer and, you know, what do I want? What did they want to see if I were them? And I tried all sorts of different approaches where, you know, I would have an intro video plan or, you know, scene playing for maybe 10 or 15 seconds, and I jump into the content. I tried so many things. Eventually, I discovered I just need to jump in and do it. You know, the some of it's kind of cool, but you know, really, I want to make it a good viewing experience and get straight into the point, get to the content, get to the message. Try to, you know, take out as much fluff as I can. And so when I first started doing all this, I just realized I just got to jump in and just do it. And then over time, I started kind of realizing what works and what doesn't. I'd watch, you know, the number of views, and I would look at the data and how long people watched the videos for. And I would test out different things to see, you know, how my viewers responded. I even polled a few people. Some people I knew that would watch my videos, I would kind of pull them and ask them, hey, give me some feedback. And there was some really good, honest, you know, frank feedback that I got from that, which helped. Like, I remember one time when I first started doing this, I would jump into a Teams meeting and I would record myself in Teams. And then I learned that the audio quality from my really expensive headset wasn't as good as a professional microphone. And so somebody gave me some really honest feedback on that. So, you know, it's just kind of trial and error until you find something that works. A lot of people say, don't focus on the tech, focus, you know, on your gear, focus on the content. There's some truth to that, but if you don't have good audio and you don't have good visual, then you don't have good content. And so if you're just getting started, you know, think about how you can make it a good experience so people want to watch and they want to stay watching. I mean, think about how many times you watch YouTube videos, you know, on a Saturday afternoon. You're going to be bouncing around ones, and if you find one that maybe you don't like, you're immediately kind of like at a conference, right? You're immediately going to the next session. So yeah, there's just a lot of little tricks there. I watched a lot of videos from others out there, other YouTubers, picked up a lot from just what they're doing. Yeah, always learning too. That's the other part of it. And I'm always kind of experimenting.
Yeah, I think, again, one of the things that I think works really well and something that I again tell people that are creating content is that when they do create, especially video content, there's that feeling that they need to pack it full of information, and that then runs to, you know, 20, 30, 40, 50, you know, I've seen some really long, you know, and they're great, you know, but you've got to allocate a huge amount of time. Having those short, you know, bites of information like you're doing, you know, 3 minutes, 5 minutes, 7 minutes, I think that's perfectly know, the right, exactly the right target here. Because, again, just focus on the one topic, go to it, cover, you know, a point or a couple of points there. Don't try and cover everything, because most people's attention span, and they don't have the time to invest, you know, hours watching a complete webcast. So, again, you know, the way that you've approached that, I think, is a recipe for success there. So,
yeah, thank you.
That's great. All right, so let's turn now to the more, you know, your day job, I suppose, let's call it, in the Microsoft sphere around security. And if we've got an audience typically of IT pros listening, what do you see that the average IT pro out there who's typically, you know, SMB style, looking after multiple clients here, what do you feel is the major thing they don't appreciate about the Microsoft security stack that they're not implementing or then overlooking, or they're just not aware of the capabilities that Microsoft is providing them that, you know, they could be implementing to make their environments more secure?
Yeah, that's a great question. Microsoft continues to surprise me. There's so many things that Microsoft does. And when you look at security, there's a lot. And, you know, I think for me, what surprises me is there's usually things you could do that perhaps don't require you purchasing a license, don't require you to go out and buy, you know, this product. And for me, it usually comes down to best practices. And, you know, at one point I mentioned earlier on in my career, I was a sysadmin. I worked at a small organization, about 100 employees. I was the IT guy, if you will. And I covered everything. It was enormous, not just security, but everything else. And so, but I never really, looking back, I never really thought about the best practices of going through my environment. And like, you know, fast forward, if it was Office 365, going through my Office 365 environment and seeing, is it configured according to best practices? Do I have the right buttons pushed and the right knobs turned? My workstations, my users use, my Active Directory environment, or if I'm running SQL or whatever it may be, just trying to align it with the security best practices that Microsoft has available. And in most cases, that doesn't require me to, you know, to make any kind of an investment in a product. It just requires my time. So that's probably the first part about it, or side one, I would say. Side two for me is, going back to kind of YouTube stuff and the blogging stuff, there's so much to learn. And when you start to get into those best practices, you start to realize, wow, here's some new knobs and new buttons I can turn and push that maybe I didn't realize were there before. And the best part about Microsoft is, for the most part, the learning's free, right? The documentation is free. There's things like Ignite videos you can watch. There's all sorts of information Microsoft makes available. So, you know, there's so much to learn about that. And you never know, right? I talk to SMB partners of mine all the time that, you know, they look at the best practices and then they look at what's available. And they're like, I didn't know that was available. And then they go out and learn about it, and they're impressed and they get inspired, and then they go light that up, and now they're showing their customer some value. So, I mean, kind of going back to your question around, you know, what's something that's maybe not appreciated. I don't want to say that best practices aren't appreciated, they are, but yeah, I think it's often maybe forgotten about, or you know, we're always looking at that shiny object in front of us and not thinking about, you know, what are some of the basic things we could be doing.
So would you also recommend looking at best practices from, you know, the government or outside the Microsoft sphere? So, you know, the CISA, and we've got equivalents here in Australia. Are they something that should also be part of the mix here?
Absolutely. Absolutely. I'm a big fan of CIS and those benchmarks that are made available. Obviously, things like NIST. When you start thinking about CCSK, there's certainly a certification with that, but that's also around, you know, securing a cloud environment. So looking at the best practices that are both inside Microsoft, absolutely, but you're going to have more than just Microsoft in your environment. And so what are some of those vendor agnostic best practices you could apply? And, you know, I've had a lot of these kind of conversations over the years where somebody asks me, where do I start? And I often refer to, hey, let's go look at the CIS, Center for Internet Security. Let's go look at their benchmarks that they make available. And let's start there, because it is vendor agnostic. So those are absolutely things you want to kind of put in your tool belt and try to implement your environment and align to it as best you can. And then using what the vendors like Microsoft makes available and any other kind of security vendor or any other vendor out there in your environment, using the best practices they make available specifically for their products. So yeah, absolutely.
All right. So if we look at, say, a product like Microsoft 365 Business Premium, and you are an IT pro that is brought into this environment fresh, and let's say that it has been up and running for a while, not appropriately or securely configured, what would be your sort of approach or recommendation, or where should somebody start to say, look, I need to get this under control. I want to make this more secure. I appreciate that I can't do it all today or tomorrow, but I obviously want to get the low-hanging fruits and make it as secure as quickly as possible. And assuming that, again, a lot of the additional features haven't been configured beyond what was provided out of the box. I mean, what sort of guidance would you give people to say, right, okay, well, break it down into these areas and focus on this one first, get that right, then move to this, and move to that?
Yeah. So great question. I'm going to answer that kind of two parts. The first part is when you read what's happening in the news around data breaches and cyber attacks, and you get into the reports that are made public by companies like Verizon, IBM, Microsoft, you know, the tech companies around these cyber attacks, and you look at the root causes of the cyber attacks, almost every time, it's going to be a cause of something super, super simple and basic. It wasn't some, sexy zero day. It was perhaps a stolen password that didn't have multi-factor authentication on it, perhaps a phishing email, perhaps a system just wasn't up to date on its patches. So with kind of that mindset in the Microsoft world, especially in something like Microsoft 365 Business Premium, what are the basics that we can do? And obviously it's going back to those benchmarks we talked about, those best practices, but then leveraging some tools that are built in, like SecureScore. So if I just go to security.microsoft.com, I log in, there's a tool called SecureScore, and every night it will go through and do a scan of the Microsoft 365 tenant of the environment, and it will give me a percentage. So let's say it's 50%. Well, what that means is if I implemented all the security features that are made available to me in the environment, I would have a secure score of 100%. But because I'm at a 50%, I have not implemented all of them. And so it's going to give me some recommendations on which features I should be enabling, how I should enable it. It gives me a chance to document it. There's some cool things there about it. And from there, I can kind of filter through them and prioritize and say, well, maybe I'm not ready for these, because maybe they're more around like data loss prevention and some of the more complex stuff that might require more of an investment of my time. But maybe looking at the simple stuff like multi-factor authentication for people who have administrative rights. If I'm the only IT person in the environment, great. Let's enable MFA on my account. Or if there's anybody else that has administrative rights, it's going to look at things like that that I could kind of prioritize. So that's usually where I recommend getting started is, let's leverage the tools like SecureScore and then pair that with, tools like ComplianceScore, that can be a conversation for another day, but just understanding where those gaps are in that environment and then taking those recommendations from Microsoft and kind of putting it through my own filter of what makes sense for my business and what doesn't. And again, it's going down to the basics. So, I think about things like that's going to show up in the report, like multi-factor authentication, like, turning on Intune to manage, any kind of mobile device and put a passcode on it or something like that. Certainly turning on things like Microsoft Defender for Office 365 to protect against email phishing. But I always start with SecureScore and let that be my way or kind of be my North Star to guide me and then branch out from there. Now, again, that's only covering Microsoft 365. We're not necessarily covering anything that's on premises at that point.
No, I totally agree. I think SecureScore is a great position to start with, and it always gives you a metric that you can go back on. Now, if the majority of people probably listening are IT pros or people who are tasked with configuring, turning the knobs and turning things on and off, as you've mentioned. I've noticed that in the Microsoft environment, as we progress and as we see the headlines in the news about all the cyber attacks, that Microsoft is beginning to enable a lot of these features by default or easily out of the box. So, for example, we've got security defaults. We've got now a configuration analyzer in Exchange Online for our policies. Now, to me, it doesn't seem like a huge step to the point where a lot of these things are analyzed, but then also with, you know, AI, machine learning, it can look at the tenant. So, you know what, your tenant's going to be better with this on than off, and it's not going to cause any impact, which is a lot of what they're doing around basic auth. Now down the track, do you see that, you know, the people who are turning these knobs are going to be potentially, you know, not doing that, and they'll have to upskill into other areas? And if so, what areas? Do you see that a lot of this basic, let's call it, you know, security 101, is actually going to be done in an automated way by things like AI monitoring the environment and making those adjustments on the fly without the need for human intervention?
Yeah. You know, one of my biggest lessons learned in my career started really when I started my career. It was like my first couple of years working in IT, and I was at that small company I mentioned. And I was going to night school for IT at one of the local community colleges. I was learning all this great stuff about Cisco routers and about Active Directory, and oh, it was amazing. Even going through my A+ certification for hardware. So I got really excited. And then at this small company, as I started taking what I learned at night and I started going to my day job, I'm like, wow, there's a lot of things here that we're not doing. Maybe I should do it. And so I started turning the knobs and pushing the buttons, right? And I quickly discovered that by doing that, caused a lot of issues, right? We had some ERP applications that ran the company and financial applications, and we had a Citrix environment, SQL, and all these different downstream things that were now impacted by doing some of these things. Even enabling something, well, back then we didn't really have BitLocker, we had, you know, crypting file system, EFS, but even enabling something like that had some dramatic downstream, you know, impact. So the moral of that story is, and kind of taking this over to tools like SecureScore, is just because it's there, yes, it's a good idea to enable it, but what's it actually mean for your environment? So, you know, you're responsible for your environment. Does it make sense to enable that? I probably, you know, sure, I could check the box. That's the easy part. But is it going to break something? And is it going to have a huge impact? And so when you think about like AI, well, first off, using machine learning to figure out patterns of, you know, how things are configured, and then using AI to possibly configure it for you. You do want to think about, and there's systems that do that. I mean, Azure Security Center will do that. There's other Microsoft products that will do that totally. But you want to think about how that's deployed, because it could impact that line of business app, and that's going to be a really bad day. So that's on my mind, but there's other things where you could tell it to configure it that probably don't have as big of an impact. But every environment's going to be different. So you want to make sure that you know your environment, you know what the tool is doing, and that's obviously going to require some upskilling, as I would call it, so that you know how to scope it. You know, all of these tools, Microsoft's, you know, included in this as well, where we can scope things to specific devices or specific groups of users or specific attributes about that thing, to tell whether or not we want that policy that's going to automatically do something be applied. Now, going to your other point, though, around where, you know, as an IT pro, where should I start, you know, learning, and where should I start going? In the field of security, and when I look at kind of Microsoft, it's really cloud security. And we've been talking about this for a number of years, but, you know, I kind of chuckle a little bit, because the cloud can do things that you just can't do when you buy a box or you buy a server. And there's advanced processing it can do, and there's advanced automation it can do to really make things easier. Like take SecureScore, for example. It would be really hard, maybe impossible, to do that on premises. So you want to understand cloud security. So kind of skate where the puck is going there, but then start learning about thing, and in the security field, start learning about how do I use the data. over the last probably 2 years, maybe three, me personally and my skill development, I have been obviously keeping up to date with Microsoft security products, but I've really been getting into the data science behind it. At the end of the day, it's just a bunch of data, right? You have a bunch of logs being sent somewhere. You've got data from, you know, the tenant and from the activity your users are doing. So you want to learn, how do I use that data to get some insights out of it and be able to identify trends? Be able to identify that, hey, we've got some threats coming in the environment and it's trending upward, or we got a trending upward of email phishing campaigns or of users that have, you know, strange, you know, behavior, whatever it may be. And being able to perform data queries. And in the Microsoft world, we use a language called KQL or Kusto Query Language that allows you to query things like Defender for Endpoint and Microsoft Cloud App Security and you know, Azure Sentinel and all those products. So using those queries to be able to find that needle in the haystack. So for me personally, my skills and kind of where I'm shifting towards is that data science behind it, writing those queries, learning how to write those queries, learning how to surface the data, and then using things like Azure Monitor and Azure Log Analytics and Azure Workbooks to then visualize that data and create dashboards so you can spot the anomalies. And then that kind of gets into a whole other topic around machine learning and developing machine learning models to then be able to look at all the data and identify patterns. So data is huge, and that's kind of one aspect of it. And before I pause here, the second aspect is around, I mentioned cloud security, and so understanding how do these cloud security products work. Like we'll take one, for example, Azure Active Directory Conditional Access, or Microsoft Endpoint Manager, or Intune, you know, understanding how it works, and then understanding, okay, how do I apply that to my environment? And you're gonna say, well, Matt, my environment's different, it's on-premises, and I have different requirements. Well, times might have changed, right? And is this an opportunity to go back and almost re-architect the way I'm doing things so that I can do it better in this new world? And so understanding how those cloud security products can apply to that is certainly, you know, part of it. But the best advice I can give is just, you know, always learn and be willing to learn and grow. And in, you know, in the IT field, that's really our job, is everything's always changing and evolving. We have to learn to survive. So that was a long-winded answer. Hopefully that helps to kind of paint a picture.
Yeah, I thought the job of the IT pro was to be someone that the end user can yell at when things don't work. So,
right.
I think that sort of happens more these days with security. I think you do need to develop a bit of a thick skin and stand your ground and say, look, you know, multi-factor authentication, for example, yes, it's a little bit more painful, but it's a lot more secure. And you're going to yell a lot more if you're losing money or, you know, can't get access to your information by not implementing it. So I'm going to stand my ground here because, again, it is best practice. It is in the standards. And I think, again, one of the things I see is that you do have to consider the impact to end users. 100% agree. But again, you've got to look at that black swan, that catastrophic event that may, again, cause, you know, massive amounts of damage to a company and potentially be terminal for the company if it isn't done. And again, simple things like MFA should really be a no-brainer.
Yeah, you know, I'll share just a very quick story here. And before I say that, you mentioned, you know, damage being done to the company. And we've seen this in the news. In some cases, the IT staff can have damage done to them, right? Job termination, even legal action for negligence. And we've seen that time and time again, just, you know, repeatedly over history in the news. So that's certainly something that's on my mind a lot, is that if, you know, as an IT pro, if I'm aware of something and I'm aware of a risk, I should probably either address the risk or let my leadership know and basically make sure my bases are covered, because eventually it could be my job is on the line and my livelihood. So that's something that comes to mind. But my short story I want to share is during the pandemic here, and I live in San Diego, California, and here locally, there's a couple small businesses I've worked with for years, and a couple of my Microsoft partners I work with also work with them. Well, one of them is a law firm, and they're a very traditional company. They have desktop computers. Everybody comes into the office. They don't really use laptops. They have a couple IT people that take care of the environment, and they outsource to a managed service provider that kind of you know, monitors everything for them. Well, when the pandemic happened, and here in the U.S., we sent everybody home to work from home, this law firm, they kind of freaked out a little bit. We don't have laptops. What do we do? Do we tell everybody to take their desktop home? Well, then they quickly realized we don't have a VPN and we don't have all these things. And in the conversations with them, they said, well, we never really wanted to give anybody remote access. And we never really want anybody to go off network because of data security and data privacy concerns, right? Because they're a law firm and they're concerned about their clients, you know, information being leaked and all those types of things. Well, when we started talking about the pandemic, when we started talking about solutions like Intune to secure a personal device and being able to leverage things like Windows Virtual Desktop and employee data loss prevention policies and all the security goodness, well, fast forward, that now enabled those end users and empowered them to be remote and get the job done remotely. And so my point to that story is really, you know, we do want to make sure that our users have a good experience, but when we look at security, there's a lot of things we can do that can empower them to have these new business outcomes like working remotely. You know, another example is contractor access. I mean, you know, think of all the different scenarios there. And that's what's fun about security these days, is you can empower those users to be more productive. You have to do it right, but you have to kind of have your eye on that end of the tunnel.
Okay. So as we're sort of beginning to round off here,
yeah, sure.
We're seeing at the moment, obviously, lots and lots of news items. The priority on cybersecurity and vulnerabilities has been raised quite significantly. It's making the nightly news. You know, the muggles of this world are actually getting to see that, you know, it is a threat that needs to be dealt with. Now, based on your experience and what you're seeing in the reporting that's coming out there, do you see this as beneficial in the fact that it's raising awareness, or is it a bit of a chicken little which will frighten people, or, you know, get them to decide that it's too hard? I mean, how do we approach this, do you feel, in a way that gets people to put the right priority and resources towards securing many environments which, you know, haven't been done or aren't, you know, anywhere near what they should be? Because the obvious thing from an end user's point of view is it's wasted money. It's money down the tube. It's money that could be better spent elsewhere. So in the grander scheme of, you know, the rising awareness of security and things need to be done and the actions taken by bureaucrats, you know, how do you see this fitting into, you know, sort of the real world from your point of view? And, you know, is it going to be of benefit, or do you think it's actually going to be detrimental?
Yeah. Yeah, I think about it a lot. And I think, unfortunately, we'll need some additional compelling events to happen for the world at large to really take it seriously. Now, some compelling events have happened in the last year, which has forced not just data breaches, but also COVID-19 has forced cybersecurity to become kind of a boardroom issue. I think we have a little bit of ways to go, and I think we're just starting that journey. Now, you know, here in the U.S., the White House has, and the Biden administration has released some cybersecurity guidance and even mandates in some cases. We've seen that elsewhere around the world. But kind of like with COVID-19, you know, we as a you know, human race, we realized, hey, if we wear masks, it minimizes the spread of the virus. And then we figured out, you know, tips and tricks to minimize the spread of the virus, and we kind of evolved over the last year. And it's made us better adapt and respond to how the virus behaves. And same thing with cybersecurity, you know, those small things I talked about at the beginning of the podcast, they add up and they make a huge difference. And so if anything, if we could just do the small little things that don't require purchasing IT products, that don't require hiring headcount and making massive financial investments, it's just a little bit of somebody's time, that could have a huge drastic impact. And it's just like, you know, I take my multivitamin every day, or I, you know, brush my teeth every day, or I go exercise every day. You know, over the course of my life, that adds up, and that could be a preventative measure against disease. Same thing in cybersecurity, just doing those basics. Now, I think we have a ways to go for this to become, you know, something that you know, becomes a mandate for every organization, every company. But I think with what's been happening in the news, it's on its way. And I think the awareness is definitely there of, you know, hey, wow, I could go out of business if I get attacked. And it's not just an attack, it's insider threats as well. You know, if I have a nefarious employee, then they want to leave the organization and take my data with them to my competitor. So in my opinion, I think we have a ways to go. But given what's been happening and given around the news and the Biden administration releasing that those mandates and guidance, I think we're in a good spot. And the business community is starting to realize the impact here. And you know, time will tell, but I'm certainly optimistic about it. And I think the more awareness, you know, that like what we're doing here in this podcast, and if there's somebody out there listening who, you know, is inspired by this and they take it to one of their business leaders of their organization, say, hey, let's go enable, I'm making this up here, but let's go enable MFA for a couple people that are maybe, you know, highly targeted or highly valued individuals in the organization. Hey, that's better than nothing. Kind of like exercising every day or taking a multivitamin, right? So
I think you're right. I think that the people are yet or beginning hopefully to make the transition between real world security. So the analogy I like to use is that even if you have chosen your suburb and you live in the, you know, with a group of friends or neighbors that you know, you still lock your house when you leave, you still close the windows, you still secure it. But again, generally, there are still windows that people could break to get in, whatever. So again, it's that balance, but there are, you know, standard steps you can take to minimize the chances of a breach or people, you know, getting into areas that you want to keep private and secure. And I think those sort of practices or that sort of mentality just needs to flow into what is relatively new technology or new, you know, implementations inside businesses.
Yeah, I absolutely agree. And you know, again, it's the little things, but it's also with this mindset of you almost have to assume breach, assume they're already in. How do we minimize it? You can't stop it. And you can't 100% prevent it. It's inevitable, right? Just like everything in life. But how can I minimize it? And how can I, you know, minimize that blast radius, as we call it? Or get to the point where you make it expensive for that attacker to just move on.
And we've known the defense in depth strategy as a race for many, many years. I think that the new concept for people is, like you said, is the learning aspect. Is like, okay, how does this traditional concept apply to our new IT environments, which have, you know, machines all over the place? They have devices which are mobiles as well as desktops, and then we've got, you know, storage here and storage there. Certainly it is a challenge, but I think the principles, as we've talked about, apply, and they're the basis on which you can build that sort of strategy. So it's not starting from scratch. It's just, okay, well, how does this translate, and do I need to improve my knowledge in that area so I know what that translation actually is going to be? So again, I think it's obviously work for people to do, and that you're never going to avoid that fact, but I don't think the process is anything alien that people would not be aware of already.
Right. Yeah, totally agree.
All right. So again, I'm sure we could sit here and talk about security and YouTube and all sorts of things for a long time, but I would like to get you, Matt, just to give us a bit of a summary and also perhaps, okay, you know, where is, apart from the great content you've created on your YouTube channel, where would you recommend people go as a starting point to learn about some of these products and turning these knobs and sort of things on in their environment? And then if also you could share any contact information for anybody who does have any, you know, feedback or follow-up for you.
Yeah, absolutely. So you can find me on Twitter. That's where I spend my social time these days. So just @SoSpinMatt. Feel free to connect with me on LinkedIn as well. I do share a lot of content and repost a lot of content there. My blog is just mattsosman.com. And of course, my YouTube channel is just youtube.com/mattsosman. So that's where you can find me. You know, where you go to, you know, learn more about this stuff and even get started. You know, like I mentioned before, one of the best things about Microsoft is all the information is made publicly available. And so there's almost endless number of resources, but the big one I reference is Microsoft Ignite. Those videos are made available online after the conference. And by watching those videos, you can learn a lot about these different products, and then it'll inspire you to go out and maybe learn a little bit more. So watching those videos out there on the Ignite website, and then going out to just docs.microsoft.com, docs.microsoft.com, is the technical documentation. So, you know, look it up for Azure Active Directory or Secure Score or anything that we've talked about. And that will, it might put you to sleep because it's a lot of technical content, but that will help you understand and learn a little bit more about what's going on. And then from there, it's just kind of branching out into the community. Microsoft has something called the Microsoft Technical Communities. If you just do a quick internet search, you'll find it. And that's message boards with folks like yourself. There's always things to be learned from each other. And with that being said, there's a huge security community on Twitter and on LinkedIn, even on Discord and other social channels that I encourage you to join. Learning from your peers is something that has helped me along my career journey. There's always something to be learned. So there's just some of the areas. And you know, along the way, you'll find out people that are influencers in the community, and you could follow them on social and kind of land and expand from there. But that's probably the, in my opinion, that's probably one of the best ways to get started is just watch those videos, read the docs, and then engage in the community.
Excellent. All right. Well, again, really good suggestions there. So I will make sure that links to those are in the show notes so people can have a look at those and use those as the jumping off point. And again, would take the opportunity to thank Matt for the time and the knowledge that you've shared with us, and also the great content that you continue to pump out at your YouTube channel. So we look forward to more information. And again, thanks again for that. In the format that you're doing, it works really well. And again, it's amazing to see the amount of content that you do create, and you know, as a content creator myself, I do realize that there is a lot of extra work behind the scenes that does go into it. So again, I think everybody would put their hands together and thank you very much for that, and obviously for your time as well today. So yeah, that's great. Thank you
so much for having me, and yeah, thanks for all the kind words, appreciate it.
Excellent. Well, again, we'll thank everybody for listening to this episode of the Need to Know podcast.
You have been listening to the Need to Know podcast from CIA Ops. For training on using technologies like SharePoint Online or Microsoft 365, visit www.ciaopsacademy.com. By purchasing from the selections available, you'll be directly supporting this podcast. To provide feedback on this episode, visit www.ciaops.com/contact.